Well, good morning and welcome back. In a day when it seems as if gay and transgender activists have made great strides in marginalizing the church and steamrolling the American people with their agenda, one expert says there are effective ways that we can lovingly but firmly push back. Joining us is author, speaker, and radio host Dr. Michael Brown, who wrote a book on this topic entitled Outlasting the Gay Revolution. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, great to be with you, Bill.
Now, a few years ago, you and I were both involved in Focus on the Family's Love One Out conferences, and I know from my relationship with you there that you believe very strongly in treating every gay and lesbian person with dignity and respect. And in fact, in the introduction to your book, you mention, I think in a very heartfelt way, empathizing with the pain experienced by many in the gay community. I'm wondering, before we get into the body of the book, can you share a few experiences you've had that have helped you to understand where these individuals are coming from?
Sure. And I do appreciate you seeing my heart in that. When God first began to burden me about these issues in 2004, it was really about what was happening in the society. It was about gay activism and where it was going. So you could say that my concerns were more of a prophetic kind to stand against gay activist work in our schools or in redefining marriage or in things like that. But I always want to really understand where people are coming from if I'm going to differ with them. So I began to immerse myself in reading literature written by gay activists, including those that were gay pastors and that said we were misunderstanding the Bible. And then I took advantage of every opportunity I had to sit face-to-face with gay activists in my community, or if I was on a long flight and I realized that the guy or the gal next to me was gay, we'd begin talking. I'd always tell them, tell me your story. Tell me your background. And the more I read, the more I listened, the more my heart began to break for the people. And what really came together in my heart was reach out and resist. Reach out to the people with compassion. Resist the agenda with courage. And one day I was sitting having lunch with a local gay activist, a young man who had been blasting me for some time. He was the editor of the local gay newspaper. He had once published an article claiming I wanted to launch a holy war against homosexuals to the death. His newspaper put a picture of my head on the body of a Muslim terrorist with an AK-47. So that's the kind of hostility that was coming towards me. And we had lunch together. And as we were sitting there having lunch, he said, you know, I realize I've misjudged you. I thought you were doing what you're doing just for, you know, like political gain or some type of power in the society. He said, I really misjudged you. And, you know, forgive me. And I said, listen, and tears started streaming down my cheeks as I'm sitting there talking to him. I said, I just want you to know the love of the Father. My heart so broke for this young man. Now, interestingly, Bill, when he then went to write an editorial about our encounter, there was only one conclusion he could come to, because he could not possibly see how I could really love God, really love him, and have my head screwed on right and not be on his side. So he basically wrote an article saying he had misjudged me. The reality is I'm a wingnut. I'm crazy. But we had a gay protest at our church some years ago, and a few minutes into it, the folks said to our folks who had gone out to greet them with refreshments and invited them into the service, they said, you guys are too nice to deserve a protest. The lead protester called my radio show the next day to apologize and said, when we came to your church, we met the love of God, and it was perfect. So as much as I'm hated and called one of the worst homophobes in the country and a vile bigot and on, anyone that's actually spent time with me or with those that we've been able to influence realizes that we do have deep love. We do shed tears wanting to see people find wholeness in the Lord. And many a time, God knows, I've agonized in prayer saying, God, I don't want to hurt people. I don't want to be perceived as an enemy, but I've got to do what's right. So it's kind of a holy tension that we walk in, really loving the people as Jesus loves them, but knowing that their agenda for society or the choices that they're making are not in the ultimate best interest of their lives or the country.
That's so well said. We are called to love the gay individual, but stand up against the agenda and the political activism. A few years ago, you wrote an article for townhall.com, and the title was provocative. It was, "I Hate to Say I Told You So." And in that article, you detailed the progression of gay activism in America. And if you would, just explain some of the steps that gay activists have taken and how they've been so successful up to this point.
Yeah, it really is striking how much was clear in advance. You didn't have to be a prophet to see this coming. In short, those who came out of the closet, we're talking about the activists in the late 60s, first they began to say, "We demand our rights." In their view, this was simply a matter of equality and liberty. Let us be who we are without society forcing us into the closet. We demand our rights. And then it escalated to, "We demand that you recognize our rights," with a specific focus on conservatives who had an issue there. And then it went to, "If you don't recognize our rights, we are going to take away your rights." And then it went to, "We want you in the closet." And when I first began to say that, those who came out of the closet want to put us in the closet, gay activists and others that I'd interact with said, "You're crazy. No one's trying to put you in the closet." Because, Bill, you've been at this for a long time. Everyone was saying, of course, we understand the religious opposition, and of course the churches don't have to perform same-sex marriages. Of course, we just want to have our rights. And what we understood was equal rights for gays was going to mean unequal rights now for Christians. So I began to say, those who came out of the closet want to put us in the closet. And they mocked me, "No one wants to put you in the closet." Well, a few years ago, the tone changed, and they said, "Bigots like you belong in the closet." And I laid out how words like diversity and tolerance and inclusivity would mean the exact opposite of what they said, and that increasingly there would be hostility towards us holding to these views in the workplace, holding to these views behind the pulpit, and laid out what was going to happen in the schools, what the curriculum would be, and where things would go in terms of redefining marriage. So much of what we laid out happened, but it was obvious it was going in this direction. And what I've tried to do is, especially after the redefinition of marriage last year by the Supreme Court, when people were so shocked and people all around the world calling me and contacting me and amazed with what was happening, I said, okay, we've been telling you this was coming for years. We were telling you there's going to be a major Supreme Court decision for years, and it's going to be a 5-4 ruling, and Justice Kennedy is going to be the influential guy. We've known this was coming for years. So are you ready to listen now? Because this is not the end of the story. This is really the beginning of the story.
Really well said. Our guest, Dr. Michael Brown, we're talking about his book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, and we will get into some of the specifics of Michael's book and his advice for all of us up next here on the Faith Radio Network. Welcome back. It's the Faith Radio Network. It's Bill Meyer with Dr. Michael Brown talking about his book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution. Okay, Michael, given the success that we've seen, we talked about this before the break, given the success of the gay activists to date, what makes you say that we can push back the tide and that the activists have really sown the seeds of their own destruction?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote the book Outlasting the Gay Revolution because I knew that the Christian mentality would be to throw in the towel. I knew that Christians would be saying, well, we lost the culture war, so let's move on. Of course, the problem with that is that the, quote, culture wars are coming to an elementary school near you, that the culture wars are coming to a church near you, that we can say, well, we lost, we throw in the towel, but things continue to progress in the wrong direction, so what do we do? Well, regardless of outcome, we're called to do what's right. Regardless of outcome, we're called to stand for marriage, for family. Regardless of whether the pro-life movement fails or succeeds in a given generation, it's called to stand for what's right. Regardless of whether the pro-abolition movement in the 1800s was going to succeed or fail, Christians needed to stand against slavery. So we stand for what's right in any case. But here's the big thing. There are seeds of self-destruction within gay activism itself. For example, it was built on the principle of, we are being bullied, we are the victims, the straight community, the society, that's the victimizer. and we are the victims. Well, now it's shifting so dramatically that the gay activists have become the bullies, and Christians, conservative believers who don't agree with things have become the victims. And Americans will side with the victims. It's almost like the old Animal Farm thing where some animals are more equal than the others. So the bullying movement is self-defeating in that regard. And what it's also doing is waking up the church, because it always goes too far. And that's another aspect with a seed of self-destruction. That right now, for example, where there hasn't been a lot of pushback about, quote, gay marriage and other things like that, there's a lot of pushback about saying a 15-year-old boy can share a locker room and shower stall with a 15-year-old girl, and she has no say in the matter. There's a pushback with Target saying a man who identifies as a woman, even dressed as a man, looks like a man, can go in and share the dressing room with females at Target. There's a pushback because gay activism goes too far. When we are told that whatever a child perceives himself or herself to be, multiple genders, no gender, the opposite gender of their biological sex, that's what it is, and the school needs to accommodate. A lot of people say, wait, this is social insanity. Perception is not reality. So gay activists are overplaying their hand. Universities saying that we don't want to have, Princeton University saying we don't want to use the word man, even man-made or man hours or anything like that. You know, are they going to get rid of freshmen? It's now fresh people or fresh individuals. At a certain point, you think, this is crazy. So they can overplay their hand. In each chapter of Outlasting the Gay Revolution, I lay out principles that if we live by these principles, we can outlast the gay revolution. Or, for example, redefining marriage. Once you so radically redefine it, you ultimately render it meaningless. There's no basis that polygamists can't push for their desires, or polyamorous can't push for their desires. One polygamous leader says, why can't Heather have two mommies and a daddy? There's no logical reason why she can't once you make these shifts. And the attack on gender, this too is something that is self-defeating. Gender distinctions, male-female distinctions, are basically what makes the world go around. It's what is a foundation for society. And yet the more you attack those, the more you have something that cannot be perpetuated through the generations. So in Outlasting the Gay Revolution, I lay out chapter after chapter where gay activism continues to go, why it can be self-defeating, and how we need to live. For example, upholding God's pattern for marriage and family, standing for the truth until lies are exposed, refusing to be bullied, how we can actually outlast these things and have a positive legacy for the coming generations.
Mm. Let's talk about a few action points that you lay out in your book, Michael, because we always like to offer that to our Faith Radio listeners.
Sure. Well, number one, never compromise your convictions. If you know something is right, regardless of cost or consequence, you have to stand for it. That's a simple biblical principle. And number two, take the highest moral ground. If there's mud being thrown at us, don't throw the mud back. This is how we overcome hatred with love. Let's remember that sexual purity trumps sexual anarchy. Our best answer for the sexual anarchy of our culture, for the anything-goes nature of sexuality, for every imaginable thing, including incest being celebrated in TV and the movies, is to cultivate sexual purity. It seems so simple, but if we cultivate sexual purity in our midst and we emphasize the importance of marriage, gender distinctions, family, raising healthy, godly kids, celebrating life, celebrating children, that alone will turn the tide. Just demographically, there will be more of us with solid families and solid kids than there'll be those that oppose. It's such a simple demographic, but if we live by that, we'll see the change. And in that regard, we celebrate gender distinctions. We don't denigrate them. We celebrate them. Doesn't mean that every man has to be a sports jock and every girl has to be a ballerina, but it means we celebrate the differences. And Bill, some things are so simple. If we'll just go back to Scripture and do what we've always known is right, cultivate intimacy with God, cultivate solid, godly family relationships, cultivate sexual purity, pour into our children, that is the simplest way that we can really outlast the gay revolution.
Now, I know you are a parent and a grandparent, Michael. Many parents are struggling with the fact that their kids are coming home from public schools with a very different perspective on sexuality than they've been trying to teach them in their home, or their youth pastor has been trying to teach them at church. What is the best way for us as parents to inoculate our kids from some of these messages they're going to get both in the public schools and certainly in the media?
Yeah, we must recognize how prevalent this is. Between media, social media, and schools, our kids are getting bombarded. Let's first be sympathetic to the fact that for our generation, as one pastor pointed out, we hear the word homosexuality, we think of an issue. Our kids hear it, they think of a person. Let's personalize this. Let's make sure that we teach our kids to be loving and respectful to all and to reach out to those who are outcast. But then the best antidote for error is the truth. Let them understand God's purposes for marriage and family. Let them understand that God made a man for a woman and a woman for a man. Let them understand that kids deserve a mommy and a daddy. And then let them understand also that ultimately there really are many negative consequences with homosexual behavior. That numbers are off the charts, for example. A gay man, 13 to 24, who were sexually active, so far off the charts with sexually transmitted diseases compared to other categories in America. Those are things to tell them as well. And we've got to help them to understand that this is not just a social opinion, that God has laid these things out. So to the extent that they really know the Lord and really honor the scriptures and really see solid role models in their own home, to that extent, they have the antidote for the social chaos they're exposed to in these other venues.
Mm. Michael, we have started early with our kids. Our kids are 13, 11, and 9, and it's actually been a few years since we started talking about this issue. Some of our Christian friends say, how could you introduce these topics to your kids? And yet we have felt it's been so important, and you know what? It's turned out that it was probably just in the nick of time, because our youngest in kindergarten, she had a classmate that had two mommies and came home asking that question. So I think you would agree with me, you need to start early and often having these conversations. And as you've said from the very beginning, you need to balance the truth in love.
Yes, and Bill, there's a preschool right where I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, right near where I live. This has been for years now. The teachers are not allowed to address the students as boys and girls because that is making a gender distinction. They have to call them friends. Mm. Not only so, they were required to, the teachers there and the workers, to read the Heather Has Two Mommy type books to four-year-old kids. It was part of the reading list. I know it because one of our ministry school students, a young woman, had to quit her job for those reasons because she couldn't go along with that. That's preschool. So we can certainly teach from the earliest age God made boys for girls and girls for boys, and how wonderful marriage is. And look, as they get older, they get introduced to more things. But let's be as positive as we can. And then if they have a heart to reach out to Billy, who gets bullied at school because the boys call him a sissy, well, let your son reach out to Billy and be a friend to Billy, rather than say, well, that means I have to affirm that two men should be able to marry. Reach out relationally, but again, resist the social agenda.
Mm, so well said. Dr. Michael Brown, his book is called Outlasting the Gay Revolution. If you want to learn more, just go to his website, askdrbrown.org. Michael, thank you so much for your time today and for your commitment to God's truth.
It's always a joy to be with you, Bill. Thanks.